this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
You talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen. Ricky on the board. SP futures up 28. NASDAQ futures up 227. So we're trying to make back yesterday. We probably are going to do that. We'll see. We have Professor Carl. What's going on? You do? I see. I hear you.
Well, you know. We got Besant, who has decided that he's going to spend your tax deposit from June.
How did you know that was the first question I was going to ask you?
Well, you know, mailing lists or something. They tend to have this prescience to it, you know. And so what's going through people's heads tends to spew out their fingers on a keyboard, right?
My question to you that I was going to ask all the way to drive in was, how exactly, when you just blow through $40 trillion in debt, does somebody manage to accumulate a $1 trillion piggy bank for himself?
Well, it's not for himself. I mean, that's...
Well, for whatever he and his cronies want to do, and his
well,
cabal.
That piggy bank has to be spent. Generally, and this is for forward obligations for the remainder of the fiscal year, which, you know, we've got 2 months, roughly.
Well, they were $400 billion in a hole last month. How do you get $1 trillion in spare cash? I mean, you're borrowing too much, or what are you doing? I mean, how does this math work? I don't get it.
Well, Chief, you know, I mean, it's like any other business. Okay, you know, I ran my company. You invoice people, they pay you, that money's in a bank, right? And then you have to pay the suppliers, and other, you know, you have to make the tax deposit to the, in this case, to, you know, some of that money that he's blowing to the
treasury. How is it different from me having, if I had 40 grand in credit card bills, and I said, don't worry, I got 1,000 in my pocket, I'm flush.
Well, that's the essence of it. But do remember that he's not retiring anything by doing this. This is one of the reasons that the market has basically stuck the middle finger up and then shoved it up his butt and broke it off, is that all he's doing through this is rolling the Treasury's coupon obligation down into shorter durations, which is extremely dangerous in a generally rising rate environment. So last thing you want to do, all right? But do recall that this is in the context of a president who has repeatedly said that we should have zero interest rates when he and Congress are running 6-7% fiscal deficits. In other words, he and his pals should get to make 6-7% risk-free while you eat it in the cost of your hamburgers and your gasoline and your health insurance and everything else.
Despite what some people say, they still somehow believe these people and somehow think that there's a... But, I mean, the idea that anything they have to do to win this election.
Chief, and this is different from any other...
It's way different.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is.
No, it's not.
So this whole Canadian situation is...
excuse me, Barack Obama took the single largest element of federal spending, the single largest, and literally shoved it in everyone's back door and broke it off for all eternity, at least to this point, because nobody's done anything about it.
So this makes it okay.
I didn't say it was okay.
It's worse, and I'm tired of looking at it. I don't care who it
well,
is.
Well, you know what? It's not worse.
It is worse.
It's the same thing. No, the numbers just get bigger because the compounding of stupidity is just like the compounding of anything else. And everyone loves it when the compounding is in their 401k balance. They hate it when it's in the grocery store. Duh.
What? The people who have wealth are doing so much better, they don't care about the grocery store.
Okay, well,
they claim they do, but they don't. I mean, there's people in this country that have made a fortune. Well, take, for instance, Trump. He's up $15 million on his oil. He's up almost $40 million on his oil holdings this year because of the Iran war.
Right.
How can you separate somebody's decisions to run the place from their portfolio when you have a personality and a background like his?
I would argue that it doesn't matter what the personality is or the person in the background. You can't separate it, and you're going to get exactly this result. But, you know, no one on either side of the aisle, and with either of the past examples or the present ones, is willing to do an effing thing about it. Okay, so, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about nice political things or whether you're talking about, well, not so nice things. But the reality is what it is, and it is going to end up coming out and becoming apparent to everyone, whether you like it or not. You're going to have to eat this, and at some point, the people of this country you're going to have one of two things. There's either going to be some kind of revolt, which would be pretty nasty, or there's going to be someone who's going to show up, probably after one of our two political parties implodes, because America's always been a two-party system. The replacement party is going to, you know, that's happened before. The Whigs went away, right? The replacement party is going to come up with somebody is going to appear and say, I can solve all of these problems, but there may be some minor little compromises.
Well, they're
going to win.
This reminds me, and actually, for me and for my investors, I was very tepid this time, back when the other people were president, and Trump before, when the interest rates got down to like 1.5% or something in the 30-year.
Yeah.
Other than when I started the business and the Dow was 800, the single best trade, which was the best trade ever in like June of 82 to buy the market. But by the way, I was about 18 months early even then, because when things started to turn, market went down another 20%, even though interest rates were coming down. So that's how much people get lined up in the momentum. Well, the best trade since then was selling the bonds.
Yeah.
And yet, I probably did that for 2 years for me and my people, and I ended up positive. But I'll bet I got it shoved up my ass 5-6 times and probably had 7 winners. And every time it was the government came out and poured even more money in the system. They went out and bought the bonds that absolutely should have gone down. So this time, when I see the inflation that everybody knows is 4-5%, maybe more, and even though these buffoons are telling us it's 2 or 3, these bonds, these long-term rates, if you take any sort of economic model and say it's the real rate of interest, which should be 2.5-3 or something, and plus the inflation, those things should be trading 7-8%.
Right.
And you and I have talked it, and yet I've resisted the urge to pour my people into selling these things, because I know the administration is going to pull some trick out of their ass. And by the way, they have.
And incidentally, it works until it doesn't.
Well, okay, it's been how many years?
Well, it works until it doesn't, and it's just like coiling a spring or stacking up cases of TNT on top of one another and then smoking in the shack, right? Which ultimately you are eventually going to have to pay the check for that. But people, nobody, everyone says, oh, no, it won't happen on my watch. It'll be, you know, it'll be the next guy that gets it. All right. Remember that Bush thought that was going to be the case, right? How'd that work out for him? So this is not an uncommon practice. And a huge part of it is the innumeracy that we promote and allow within our population. And I don't know how you fix this, Chief. It's been a problem forever, literally forever. And yet here we are with an interest rate cycle that has nothing to do with political policy. It's a long wave cycle. There's nothing you do about it. It's driven by human stupidity and greed. And it happens repeatedly. There have been many of them throughout our nation's life. There have been even more of them through other, you know, if you look at this on a global basis, they tend to roughly align, which, frankly, from my point of view, is surprising. I'm quite surprised that, for example, the guilt alignment in Britain is almost absolutely lockstep with the alignment in the United States, seeing as we kind of threw them out in 1776. So that alignment has stuck surprises me.
Why?
Maybe it shouldn't be. Well, I guess maybe it shouldn't, because trading partners, you know, to some extent.
The same people that are in control here, the one percenters or the one-tenth of the one percenters, are in control everywhere for 15, 20 years. I mean, if I were to debate Rick Santelli on CNBC, you know, I like Rick a lot. He's done a good job for a long time. But if I were to say, look what we're doing to the dollar, he would immediately say, what are you talking about? It's even or strong compared to the pound, the euro, and the yen. It's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah, right. I get it.
But that's what people, because the same, whoever, even though Trump with his bluster keeps bitching about all these other countries, the fact is, whether he knows it or not, the central banks are totally in lockstep.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's no way that Britain or euro is going to say, we're not up on our money supply. We're not going down, and then all of a sudden have the dollar get its ass kicked. It's not going to happen.
But Chief, that's one of the reasons, okay, that this thing that Bessent did with the yen surprised me, right, in that he shoved it up the ECB's back door.
It surprised you in the way he did it. It didn't surprise you that he was going to do something.
No, but it surprised me that he did this without any notice to them at all, okay, that he did it literally behind their back way that he did it.
He's taking a massive risk there.
Well, no kidding.
Because I think the fact that everybody has been tied together in this whole mess, I mean, the COVID situation, everybody poured money into the system.
Yeah.
So you could actually say, what do you mean the dollar is strong? Compared to what? Not compared to a car.
Right.
It's strong compared to the euro because they're doing the same thing.
Right.
But I don't see how at this point we I've never seen it quite like this, where, you know, I have clients that, you know, somehow bought into, not somehow, it was a good buy. They liked the computers and they couldn't believe it when the stock went down to 7 when what's his name left and he came back, the guy at Apple. And all of a sudden, you know, these are life-changing events. I mean, there's only so much somebody who owns 10,000 shares of Chevron can bitch about the gas prices. I mean, come on.
Right.
I mean, duh.
Well, no, I'm with you on that, Chief. And I mean, you know, there's another aspect of this too, which is that we have a Congress and a presidency and big shock, also a judiciary, duh, that has a group of people, including themselves in many cases, who are absolutely tied at the hip with those people who profit from these particular policy decisions. You take a look at what's going on right now in this whole Iran thing. The crack on diesel has never been anywhere near where it is now. Right? It's at a record high.
How would you like to be the guy, Trump's buddy, Trump's buddy who got Citgo out of bankruptcy about 2 weeks before this happened?
Well, I'm just saying, I would absolutely, if I owned...
Actually, 2 weeks before the Venezuela thing happened.
You know what? If I owned a couple of oil refineries, I would probably be willing to pay for Trump's ballroom myself.
Oh, sure, sure.
Okay, in cash. Because, by God, that kind of a crack spread has never been seen before in the context of diesel fuel. And I am just rolling in the cash.
Well,
and all because BB and he decided that they were going to go blow these guys up.
Well, if you add to that, the guy who got the Venezuelan oil when we...
There's another one. Yeah.
He dug it out of bankruptcy, 2 weeks before the Venezuelan incident? I mean, we have people that...
What amazingly propitious timing.
Well, the morality is so far... I think, you know, I'm starting to feel this way. I don't think the morality is ever going to come back to anything that I think it ought to be. So in that maelstrom of crookedness, which we see all over the damn place, you see it driving around. It's all over the place. I mean, in that mess, I guess it's every man for himself. And I think that's what people, and I think an awful lot of people are totally disgusted with the man in the Oval Office, but as long as they think he's going to be okay for their stock, they're willing to ride with it, despite every other friend. I was reading this Canadian stuff, and I can't believe it. I listened to about 15 people talk. Why do we think we can tell them to not put French on their products? When it's their friggin' language, for God's sake. Why do we think that we can tell them who they can trade with?
Well, now there's a good one right there.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, what is it constantly... I mean, I'm no fan of Elizabeth Warren. But she was interviewing that Lutnick, Mr. Epstein, take his family to Epstein's Island, Lutnick.
Yeah.
And she says to him, what do you gain by telling Canadians they suck? How does that help you in your negotiation? I mean, what are you doing? What are you doing? Why do you have to call people names? And he's like, well, this and that and the present. She goes, wait a minute. How does that help you in any kind of negotiation? Right. I mean, what are you doing? They've been our friends for 200 years, for God's sake.
Well, the Canadian thing is, as I pointed out when Trump first came back into office, that there is very serious trouble in terms of the exploitation, especially since Carney got back into his position.
Which side you read.
Well, always, okay. But looking at this, the reality of all nations' trade systems, whether we care to admit it or not, because we do the same effing thing, okay, is that every one of them, every nation has industries that they have an interest in protecting in some way, right? We're not alone in this. Canada has it too.
We have sugar. We have lumber.
Canada has
dairy, and Japan has rice. I mean,
Everybody's got some. That's what I just said, okay? But the reality of it is that some of this is backdoor stuff that doesn't have, you know, that is somewhat indirect. So one of the issues that Canada is dealing with, and it has an impact on us as a consequence of what they're doing, they've got the same kind of importation of labor from outside their country that we have. They have exactly the same issue. The whole H-1B thing, it's got a different name there. It's not called H-1B because, of course, Canada is not the United States. But they've got the same thing going on up there. And, by the way, that goes directly into any kind of skilled position, its wage base, and the impact that it has in trade agreements. People do not want to deal with this because if you go there, then you have to deal with your own sins in that regard. And, of course, we do not wish to do that. But we're going to get forced to do it because this is really not very complicated. You've got Kroger that just took an entire department, 5,000 employees in Cincinnati, and they are shoving that entire department.
They have 5,000 employees in one place?
Chief, that's their headquarters.
Okay, but I mean, how big of a building do you need for 5,000 IT people, for God's sake?
Well, it's not just in one location, but it's... Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a huge chunk of people that all of whom probably, being that the type of job it is, and that it's in a high-cost area in Cincinnati, in the middle of a city, I'm willing to bet every single one of those people makes $100,000 a year or better.
Probably. Well, I'm somewhat, when I say disappointed, I don't know that that's the right term, because I don't know how I could tell how anybody's actually feeling. But how do you have somebody come out and say, we're putting a huge tariff, 50% tariff, on Canadian automobiles? What's the Canada car that I'm missing?
Well, it's not the Canada car, it's the componentry and assemble and final assembly.
Okay, so if we assemble a Ford in Toronto, right, we're going to charge somebody here 50% more?
Well, I'm assuming that the 50% is on the value add, because that's normally how those work.
But I'm saying we're talking,
it's not
about
on the gross price.
But these are Fords and Chevys that are being made up there.
Yes. And okay, and by the way, they're being made in Mexico too.
Okay, but my point is they keep saying Canadian cars. There is no Canadian car. Do you have to lie all day long?
Well, they're Canadian cars, just like they're Mexican cars.
Okay.
I mean, look, my truck has a sticker on the inside of the door.
But if you say we're gonna put a 50 years ago, if you said you're gonna put a tariff on German cars, you know what you're talking about. We're talking about a Mercedes that ends up at the dock. This is a little more complicated than that. When you go by a Silverado, or actually it was a Ford, whenever it's being assembled in Toronto, you know, 50 feet over the, well, a little more than that, over the border, and being sold here. And by the way, if you drive through Canada, all they do is drive American cars.
This is a lot different
than putting a tariff on a Volkswagen 50 years ago.
Okay, it is, but it isn't. Remember, by the way, Ross Perot was right, and we did this to ourselves by allowing this to take place. Canada has attempted to exploit this. No surprise, every country does. They have, to some extent, managed to get something out of it. David, if you want to see something, I never thought I. Look, I've been in, when my daughter and I went up there just before her 21st birthday, so this was close to 10 years ago now, about 8 years back. I hadn't been in Toronto for probably 20 years.
You got the world's best hot dogs.
Well, I used to go there on a somewhat regular basis, okay, because it's kind of a neat place, or at least it used to be kind of a neat place. The change in attitudes, demographics, everything else that goes into a city. If you'd been going all this time, like anything else, when the frog gets boiled slow, you don't really recognize it, right? It was stunning, to put it mildly. It was absolutely gobsmacking, jaw-dropping stunning. Not in the kind of situation that I'm worried somebody's going to knife me or something like that, right?
It's way safer than here.
Well, I'm not looking at it from that point of view. I'm just saying that the general character of the place, the premise of being Canadian, you know, hey, you know, the McKenzie brothers, hey, get off, right? Gone, completely effing gone. And oh, by the way, the cost of living, just ordinary things that you might want to buy, a beer, for example, absolutely through the effing roof. Now, how anyone who happens to live there and is Canadian manages to put up with that is beyond me. But obviously they are, because the city is still there.
Okay. Well, a lot of it has to do with the taxation and what you get for it, you know, which...
Well, and you know what? It is not not my place to argue whether or not it's good or bad. The people, that's their job. It's their
country. I'm not saying I like it either, but explain to me. I know I couldn't ask anybody in the Oval Office. Now, this car stuff is pretty complicated. I went through it a couple years ago. I think I went through it with you, but it's been full faded memory. All right, so we're going to assemble, let's say, an F-150 in Toronto. I think it might be the Chevys that are up there, but whatever it is. All right, so we're shipping the motor and the transmission to Toronto. Now there's going to be a 50% tariff on that from them. Okay, so then the car is assembled. and now we're going to ship, or the truck, now we're going to ship the truck here. When are the two populations going to say, knock it off, guys?
Well,
what's the F-150 going to cost me next week? $200,000?
Well, no, the F-150, the intent of these kinds of moves, and it doesn't matter which side they're on, the intent of these kinds of moves is to localize the construction of whatever it is, the manufacturing of whatever it is, back into the state where the final consumption takes place, back into that nation. Okay, that's the intent of these kinds of
things. What do you suppose?
I'm not saying it will be successful or won't be successful. I'm saying that's the
obvious
intent. But
do our buffoons even know that? I mean, what do you suppose if a F-150 is assembled in Toronto, just like I had the discussion yesterday regarding if the Chinese own the company that's building the CTA cars here, if the spec says you have to use Carl's trucks and motors, Ricky's air conditioners, and somebody else's, they're all made here, and oh, by the way, the labor's here, you're probably talking 85%, 90% of the car is U.S., the railroad car.
Yeah, but the
But I'm saying, how does that shake out in a pickup truck assembled in Toronto?
Okay.
What is made there versus here?
Chief, I understand why these kinds of things happen in the first place. Nobody, and yet this happens, okay, in today's world, this happens. Nobody in their right mind takes a transmission, ships it across, now the Gordie Howe Bridge was the Ambassador Bridge, okay, ships it across the Ambassador Bridge, has the control module added to it, married to it, whatever, tested, and then some other part of the assembly comes back across the Ambassador Bridge and goes to a final assembly plant down the road from Detroit. Okay, no one in their right mind does that.
I think they do.
Unless, but they do it.
Yeah.
Okay, now,
different than having the transmissions made in Chicago. It's just the same distance from Detroit to Toronto.
Well, but the only reason you do that is that there is enough of a labor cost disparity all in. Okay, not just wages, but all the other costs that go into this. There's enough of a labor cost disparity that it's less expensive to do that than it is to stick the transmission control manufacturing plant halfway between the guy that makes the transmission in Ohio and the final assembly plant outside of Detroit. Okay.
There's factories all over the place that don't have. It's not every single time somebody gets an immigrant. They have a lot of people that do stuff well.
Chief, I'm not. I didn't say it's an immigrant. I said the cost structure in that place, whether it's through immigration legal or not, whether it's through taxation, whether it's through health care, whether it's through whatever it is, the cost structure is different enough that the arbitrage makes sense.
It doesn't, but it doesn't have to be. Carly, I used to do this crap in my younger days. There was a lot of stuff that Pullman could have made, yet somebody on the outside who specialized in that sort of...
They were cheaper.
They were cheaper. And it wasn't like they paid their people less.
Look.
You sort of were hinting at that.
No.
They happen to be better.
I'm not saying it is necessarily because they pay their people less. I'm saying that the cost of operation in that place, all in, is less expensive than doing it here.
It could be... You have the latest side extrusion machines.
There's all sorts of reasons it happens. Okay, but when a nation determines, for good or for bad, for right or for wrong, that this is an abusive practice, that's when these barriers go up.
Well, or
Joel's up, so I'm.
Or they do it just because they want to do it, because they have a predisposed idea of what's good and what's bad. Anyway, I don't know about Kenny, but we'll be back maybe today or for sure Friday, or maybe actually might need you a little bit on Wednesday, tomorrow. We'll talk.
All right, let me know what's going on.
Okay, Joel, what's up, buddy?
Good morning, Chief. How you doing today?
All right. So your truck, your new truck from Canada is going to cost you what, $200,000?
I guess that's what they tell me.
Yeah. I'd go buy one tonight if I were you.
Yeah, is that going to stick? I mean, is
there
anything that you hear along these things? I mean,
does
it actually hold true?
I don't know. It seems we like chaos, and I don't know why we like chaos. I'm not big on chaos, but it's just me.
I look at the different things that have gone over. You know, they've been in the news and the focus, and I'm like, okay, well, this bond purchase I really don't understand, and I don't understand this economic pressure, and Iran, I don't understand, and then, like, all of a sudden, we're back to fighting with Canada, I don't understand, I just, a lot of things to think about here. Oh, and Jackson Hole, which, you know,
yeah.
People make the world's biggest deal out of, and I don't know. What are you going to sit there with your fingers on your keyboard and make investment decisions based on what comes out of these guys' mouth, which is going to be unequivocal at best? And then you got NVIDIA earnings, you know, The whole world waiting on an NVIDIA earnings. So.
They're tonight or tomorrow?
Tomorrow
night. Well, I mean, it is. I can't imagine if there's other people in this universe. Somebody sitting listening to the news on like the fourth moon of Alpha Centauri or someplace. Last week we go through a deal where we just went through $40 trillion, okay, in terms of debt. And oh, by the way, 2 days later, it was already up another $50 billion. Then we have our esteemed Secretary of the Treasury says, don't worry, I got $1 trillion in the kitty for whatever I want, to use wherever I want. I'm going, where does that come from? It's like me having a $100,000 credit card bid, but don't worry, I got $1,000 in my pocket. Let's go drinking. I mean, how does somebody even say something like that? What does that mean? He borrowed too much, and it only should be $39 trillion. I mean, what's the message?
I have no idea. I just wonder if they're gonna, Warsh and Bessin are gonna put on the gloves at Jackson Hole. You know,
no, they're very coordinated. I think they're very coordinated.
No, coordinated chaos then, right?
Yeah, I mean, I had a feeling that these interest rates started to go up before the elections, and they were going to do something. I'm really surprised that it didn't come from the Fed, that it's coming from the Treasury. But it just means that's probably money that maybe the Fed, since they have all these things on their balance sheet, things meaning mortgages and U.S. bonds and stuff, they still got a bunch of mortgages. I don't know how much Carl will probably find out. So they're getting interest payments every month, right? Either from, and every once in a while, once or twice a year, they actually give that back to the Treasury, correct? What they've actually earned after they go through all their expenses of running their, you know, Fed banks and all that stuff. I mean, the Fed has a huge budget and, like, you know, clearing checks and all the other stuff and doing the things overseas. I mean, they have a huge job to do that has nothing to do with what we hear, correct? I mean, they have, you know, they essentially are the central bank. I mean, if you write a check, it goes through the Fed from your bank to the other bank. So they actually have a big job to do that costs a lot of money, and they have people there. So whether it's too many or too little, who knows? But they have expenses, but the interest they get from this, the rest, if it's excess, they kick it back to the Treasury. Correct? Now is that the money he's using, or does anybody even know?
I don't know, Chief. I don't know.
The detail is just kind of weird. I mean, and I was ranting with Carl. We have a whole group of administrative people ranting about Canadian cars. There is no Canadian car. It's not like it's a Mercedes or a Honda, is it? Is there a Canadian vehicle that I can go buy? I'm buying U.S. stuff from that's assembled there. Does anybody think that's a little different, isn't it? It's not like lobbing a tariff on a Mercedes 20 years ago when it comes to the dock all ready to go, right?
Hey, that's exactly right, Chief. You're exactly right. I don't know who makes, you know, who's giving input into these decisions and who's giving feedback.
I don't know. It's kind of crazy. So where does that leave? Where does that leave the market? We were down a couple of days. Now we're back up. I think that you don't want to short it before the election, unless all of a sudden every poll comes out the other way.
Yeah, I'm not even sure what the polls are indicating, Chief.
I don't know how you'd even do a poll today, do you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole nother topic that I don't think I want to go into.
Well, I did a little study of that in school. I mean, I never did anything, but just the idea, how do you find somebody today? How do you even do a random sample?
I don't even know.
I don't either.
And then you got the prediction markets really trying to influence things. The poly market and there's money out there trying to dictate things in certain directions. So there's a lot of things that are coming to a head, and a lot can happen between now and November, and then we'll see what happens in November.
Well, the things that are startling, not to wander off on a... When was this Wisconsin vote? I heard the statistics the next day, so I think they're right. Who the hell knows? But the race in Wisconsin was neck and neck. It was well-publicized. It was a national thing, right? Just for the governor or whatever. And still only 25% of the people voted.
Yeah. Oh, I think there's going to be some big turnouts here in the elections in Michigan, and I think other places. I think
What are the hot races up there?
Well, the governor race. It's more the senatorial race. The Democrats, which haven't lost in Michigan since 1994, have an interesting candidate, and the Republicans are, running a typical Republican candidate. So
we're not talking about
it. I mean, not so much what's going to be influenced in Michigan, but what happens to the complexion of the Senate, and things are probably not going to change that much. But there's certainly a lot of groups calling for a lot of change.
Well, I mean, we need something. I don't know if the change is, if it's not the right change, it's not necessarily the best idea, right? I mean, we're sort of at a crossroads economically here. I mean, in terms of the debt and everything else, we need somebody that's not going to have an agenda of some craziness. We need somebody who's actually going to manage the place, don't you think, for a while? I don't really care what side of the alley comes from.
I would like to see, I mean, we've talked about this before. Things get out to the extreme, extreme right, extreme left, and there doesn't seem to be much in the middle right here. So hopefully, we can find that equilibrium somewhere in the middle. But it's, the way the pendulum swings, and it tends to swing, violently in both directions.
Well, I still think, and this is a poll of one person, that anybody who is somewhat moderate, be a Democrat or Republican, are kind of awash in the ocean. I don't know that, adrift in the ocean. I don't know that they have a side. I mean, I can't go with the group in Washington, but I could certainly go for a moderate Republican. I can't go with the far left, and I could certainly go with a moderate Democrat. I don't see anybody, do you? I mean, what do you think about the Tucker Carlson and his guys thinking about a third party for 28?
Chief,
I don't know how you pull that off.
No, I don't. But all right, I got a hop here. We'll keep an eye on NVIDIA earnings.
What are you thinking there?
I don't know. I mean, they've the last four quarters they've sold off. They've been trailing the S&P for the last year. It usually trades in a more of a trading range after from one report to another. This one, we had different circumstances, but looking at it from a technical perspective, I mean, I really don't see major support until, 190, and then it's been unable to break out over 230. So that's a pretty big range to deal with. But we'll see. We'll see what happens at Jackson Hole. We'll see what happens with some of the economic data this week.
Give me one second. I've got those guys at about a $14 straddle. Boy, I don't know if it's enough to you.
That seems cheap.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
Yep. All right.
Okay, we'll talk at you, bud. S&P futures up 32, NASDAQ futures up 254. Do we have Kenny?
I don't see Kenny yet, but we still have Carl.
All right, well, Carl, pop in until Kenny. I think Kenny's in. He might have told me he's going. So he's been very popular on the TV shows. He's been on with Maria a lot.
Yeah, we'll see. You know why he's still on the TV shows? Because he didn't say that all the Goldman Sachs executives needed to go to prison in 2008.
Like, well,
which is how I got blackballed, which, by the way, still stands today.
Once blackballed, always blackballed. You know that.
Well, that's the way it works. Yeah, I mean, and oh, by the way, it wasn't just on Fox. It's across all the major networks. CNN, CNBC, none of them can book me, which is rather amusing. I know people that work there. So Fox tried to book me about a year and a half ago, and they were told that the producer was told by upper management, oh, you can't book that
guy. Wouldn't you like someday, maybe in our next life, we can look down and actually find the men behind the curtain?
Well, I have a pretty good idea who some of them are, and if I am looking, I'll probably be looking up from the next life rather than looking down. But if I do, I would be very happy to make a deal with a guy down there to send something evil this way come. God. You know, just saying. I mean, you know, a little tornado action, a little lightning action.
Yeah, a little something, something.
A little something, something, right?
Well, I just, you know, we kind of laugh at some of the corruption. I remember my uncle, by the way, last week his son sent me a thing that he'd been 112 today, or last week. And I remember my uncle, Dante was his name, whatever we call him, Danny.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, well, he was very, very Italian. When Richard J. Daley was mayor, and you know, Chicago was the city that worked, right?
Right.
And my uncle said something like, the corruption is at the right price, everybody knows it, and everybody's comfortable with it.
Yeah, well,
he says you're not going to change people.
Chief. You know, that's one of the things. As I moved, you know, when I moved to Florida, and then, you know, then again up here into Tennessee, I had both times had people like, you know, oh God, man, the corruption here is horrible. You know, I had a guy that was one of the county commissioners that owned a title company in Florida, okay, and they were so of course, more transactions is more money for him, right? He doesn't get a, you know, it's not as bad as a realtor in that, you know, there it's a percentage of the deal, so you want higher prices, obviously, duh. But more transaction. What he wants is turnover, right? Because that's how title companies make money.
Yep.
They were scheduling commission meetings in very in difficult places to get to with times and stuff, and so I showed up because they were raising taxes on people, and I raised hell on behalf of myself and others. He actually called me a fat cat who could afford it from behind the dais, and so I went after him for conflict of interest and managed to get an op-ed in the local paper. They and I, needless to say, didn't like each other very much. You've got it too. Here the big thing is, if you want to set up a distillery or a liquor store, you could have problems.
I hear somebody in the background. Is that Kenny?
I think Kenny is.
It
up.
Is.
Yep.
So
Kenny,
all
right.
It is.
Wait, last thing on the corruption part, though, is when there was a price that, I don't know if they were World War II people or whether everybody kind of was in the same boat, but if you had a, you know, say Ricky was my nephew and he's a good kid and he's out of a job, I can go to the precinct captain and I could get Ricky a job. Now, it wasn't going to be general of something, but by the way, he better show up and not embarrass me and those kinds of things. But now it's reached the point where Madigan wanted 2-3 jobs and they didn't even show up. Well, how does that move?
Chief, now it's just a bribe.
Right. And I'd say to the guy, get Ricky a job, and by the way, I'll work a polling place for you a couple times. There was a price, there was something, you know, there was a little bit of a skib. But it was something that everybody could sort of handle. And then all of a sudden, people just take it to the nth degree, and then you look at it and you go, how did we get here? How does Ricky not even show up? What kind of a deal is that?
well, like I said, it's just at this point, the corruption has gotten so bad, it's just a bribe.
Yeah, it's just... So
that's
Kenny,
all it is.
Kenny, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
All right, so were you on TV talking about the Canadian situation? And
I was talking yesterday on... On Mornings with Maria, I was on there yesterday. We hit on it just a little bit. But yeah, because there was, you know, a lot to talk about. But yeah, the Canadian situation continues to be very interesting in terms of how that's going to unfold, where we're going to see whether or not we get, you know, cooler heads to come to the table. But as of this morning, I don't think there are, right? I think it continues to be this tit for tat, isn't it?
Well, from what the Canadian side, I listened to about three or four of those guys. When they started getting into, we have to approve any other trade deal, and oh, by the way, you can't have French on the instructions or something, where do we decide we get to go there?
Wait, say it again? What did you say?
They were going to try and say you couldn't put French, you know, you have to take French out as your national language or something.
I have no idea. It's stupid. Why would we even have suggested that? And who on our side would have suggested
that? Well, you know, the one they had three people on. Ron Insano was on it. You know, I always liked him. He came to one of our seminars. Is he still involved with CNBC? Are you a buddy of his?
I am a buddy of his. He is not. He's he does more on the MS Now network, which used to be MSNBC, but
okay.
It's MS Now network. I don't think he's. I think his contract at CNBC ended, and so now he's a voice on MS Now, doing the same thing, business and stuff. But that's where I think he is now. I should call him this morning.
Well, he was on with a couple of people. It was a really good video, and there was three people. And I said, you know, people here don't. They don't understand how insulted people up there are by the 51st state and all the other stuff. I mean, because they're a proud people. Nobody'd like that. Somebody saying that to us, and yet we do it to other people. What are we doing? And I don't get it. I mean,
I don't understand it either. And they should be insulted. Quite honestly, if I were Canadian, I'd be insulted too. Like, who does Trump think he is to start talking about Canada's the 51st state and all that stuff? It's a separate country. It's one of our biggest trading partners. What the hell is going on?
I can see you have some Italian blood in you.
Yeah.
Hey, buddy, what do you think you're doing?
I mean, come on. You know, I can't blame it.
We might be old, but we're not dead, Kenny.
I mean, I don't blame the Canadians for being pissed off. They, you know, it's ridiculous. But again, I don't know what the extent of some of the negotiations are. But the fact that, you know, you're asking them to go with French and all that stuff is ridiculous. Like, why would you do that?
Because it's all comes from the same thing, that they should be part of us or something. I don't know, that crazy stuff. But what do you make of? I was mentioning earlier that even though I thought with the inflation creeping up here, that's nobody kind of admitting to it, that these long term rates were going to keep going up. Yet I have resisted after the last time when they got down to 1.5. I won't say every time, but a lot of times I tried to sell bonds, even though I think on the whole thing, Kenny, I end up a little positive. Every time I tried to do it, you know, it was, you know, somebody shoved it up my behind, the government buying the damn thing. So I've resisted this time. And sure enough, you know, we got a treasurer that comes out that says he has a trillion-dollar kitty to essentially buy what he wants. And I'm going, where did that come from?
I don't know where it came from. It seems that feels desperate to me because, look, you and I both know. He can temporarily, you know, kind of change the tone of the market, but he's not going to change the long-term settlement of where yields are going to go. The market is going to define that, right? Buyers and sellers in the market are going to determine what yield should be. He can get in there and disrupt it short-term, but he's not fixing the problem. And part of the problem is, you know, the out-of-control spending, the inflation, all this stuff that he can't necessarily control right now. Because raising rates by 25 or 50 basis points is going to do nothing for the conflict in the Middle East. It's going to do nothing for the price of oil. And so him buying bonds, using the money, wherever he's getting the money from, this new kitty bank that he's got, trying to buy bonds and trying to bring yields down the long end, it might work for a day or two or a week, but it's not going to work long term. So in my mind, I think it's a fruitless action, and I think that the... you know, there's going to be a ton of issuance coming, but not only government issuance, but corporate issuance that's coming. And I actually think that longer-term rates are going to tend to move a little bit higher. I certainly don't think they're collapsing. I'm not sure they're running, but, you know, to 8%. but I don't think they're I don't think they're coming in. I think they're actually going to move from here. They're going to move a little bit higher. That's going to be my guess. I think that puts us into the, you know, closer to the danger zone. I think we're already in it. Like, once you get the 4.75 on the 10-year, I think that starts to be headwind for the market, headwind for investors and that kind of stuff. You know, you may define the danger zone, like the real danger zone, it better than 5%. I think we're starting to get to it at 4.75.
Well, we but, 6 months ago, we said we'd be there at 4.5. Now we've ratcheted up 2.5, both of us have.
Yeah, right. Anyway.
But just the whole concept of last week, every news show was how we blew through $40 trillion. And this week, a guy goes, don't worry, I got a trillion here in petty cash that I can spend. it's like saying,
yeah, but you know, yeah. You really can't, because that money's not just sitting there. That's money that moves in and out of that account, right? To help balance the, you know, balance the economy and balance the payments and all that stuff. So that stuff, that money's moving constantly in and out. So he doesn't have. It's not like it's just sitting there saying, okay, spend me, right? It's used for other purposes. So you got to be careful on how he uses it and what he uses and how much of it he uses, if he's even going to really do that. My mind is, I think it's a, like I said, I think it's a wasted effort, because in the long term, it's not. He's not going to be able to determine what long bond yields are. The market will determine that based on buyers and sellers.
Well, it will, but it makes you tepid to go in the day before and have him run over you the next day.
Yeah, agreed. No, agreed. But look, when he announced it on Wednesday, you know, everyone reacted positively and bonds caught a bid and yields went down and blah, blah, blah. But then on Thursday, everyone's sitting there going, whoa, let's think about this for a minute, you know, and then we saw what happened on Thursday. Now, and on Friday, I think the market rallied only because it had gotten to a short-term oversold position. The yield ended up still going higher on Friday, and the market went up, which didn't really make sense. If you're trying to use that same logic, it didn't really make sense. But I think it's the bond market that's going to start driving, or that is driving, the stock market. I think the higher yields go, you know, the more pressure we'll see on stock. And I don't necessarily think that means the market's going to crash. But what I mean is, I think it's going to put a lid on how far stock's going to go right now.
Well, I mean, I think it might, but I don't. The fact is, if they're going to pour, you know, how can I explain this? You're sort of in the same spot, and really, everybody on the show is in the same predicament. How far we've got money pouring into the system, we've got debt basically out the ass, and the question is. We all think, even if you don't like the people in power, which I don't, but even if you don't, you think that somebody somewhere, and I know I feel this for my investors, I feel this way, and probably I shouldn't have. Somebody somewhere, even Trump's going to say, we can't do any more of this. I mean, this is as far as we can go. We can't continue.
Yet, agreed.
Yet I don't see it. I mean, now
I don't think it's going to be Trump, by the way.
Well, but I mean somebody there, whoever it is. But I mean, there's going to be somebody that says, somebody who says to him, maybe, we can't do this. I mean, if you know, this inflation is going to, we keep pouring money in like we're doing. Even Warsh, who's supposed to be stopping it, isn't. You know.
Well, so, I mean, I would think. Listen, I have a lot of respect for Bessent. I believe that he knows right from wrong. So I have to believe at some point. He's going to say, look, this is not the long-term solution. This is not the long-term solution. You know, we could try it for a short term, but at some point, I have to believe he's the one who's going to say,
I think
look.
To a certain extent, and I'm not just blaming these guys, everybody looks at, I'll say this unequivocally, I think they will do whatever they have to do. They will mortgage whatever future we may have. If they have to pour money in to run the market up and talk about how well they're doing, they'll do whatever they have to do between now and the first week of November. And I'm not saying that there hasn't been a succession of presidents that have done that, but maybe I'm just recognizing it better, maybe these guys are more extreme, or maybe I think the market's too high. But there's going to be no common sense, no discipline whatsoever between now and November 6th, or whatever the date is. And you know what?
Right.
And if inflation's 5% next year, if they're back in office, they'll say it's a small price to pay. Because they're not paying it, you and I are.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying, I mean, you and I go back to how pissed off was Bush at, what's his name, Greenspan. Bush won.
Yeah, Bush won at Greenspan.
Yeah, I mean, how long, I mean, Greenspan didn't do what he wanted him to do, and he blamed part of the election loss to Clinton on Greenspan, didn't he?
Well, I think he blamed it on that. But listen, don't forget, but part of his election loss was also his no new taxes. Remember that?
Well, I mean, there was more. I'm saying there was more to it. But in the end, he felt that if they'd have poured some money in, it would have kicked the market up and something.
It would have helped him. For sure. Yeah, but they're all going to feel like that. If the Fed doesn't do what they want and they lose in the next election, it's always easy to point at the Fed.
Well,
right?
Sure.
To say, well, the Fed didn't help out, or the Fed didn't do this. It's not the Fed's responsibility necessarily to make sure the current president gets elected or not, although you can argue that they did it for Joe Biden, 3 weeks before the election when they lowered rates by 50 basis points in September before the election. For Joe Biden, right? Remember, everyone had
When you start telling everybody you're going to fire him,
right?
It's not exactly winning friends and influence of people style.
Yeah, no, I agree.
By the way, Kenny, if I get in office, I'm firing your ass, and all of a sudden you work against me the last week. Well, duh.
Oh my God!
I mean, it's the truth. Look, I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's the truth, isn't it?
It is. But look, this week we're in the final week of the summertime, right?
Yep.
I mean, really, next week goes into Labor Day, but this week and next week is the final week, so volumes are lower, moves can be exaggerated. We got Nvidia tomorrow, which is certainly going to hold everybody hostage because they're going to hang on every single word. And don't forget, the expectations are enormous, right? For Jensen Huang, right? And so everyone's going to hang on every word. What did he say? What did he mean? What does he really mean? Did he say it this way? What was the tone of his voice? All that kind of stuff. I fully suspect that what's going to happen is, like usual, they're going to hit the sell button at first, because I don't think Jensen Huang is going to disappoint at all. Although, this idea that came out yesterday that Nvidia servers are going up by 15% because of the DRAM costs and the memory costs and all that stuff. So it's going to be interesting to see what he says about margins and whether or not the spending is slowing coming from the hyperscalers based on these new price increases and all that stuff. So that will be certainly something that everyone's going to pay attention to. But in the end, I think it's going to be fine. And the move in Nvidia is going to be, the options market says, it's going to be a 5.7% move in either direction. So that puts us in the 198
kind
of 218. They've already taken some. The stock's down 3 days in a row. Yesterday it was down 3%.
I got the straddle.
I think it was.
What do you? I got the straddle at 14.
Oh, you have it at 14. Well, of when? Is that as of this morning?
Well, as of last night. It's only up $2.
Okay. Okay. So then that's new news. I thought it was. I read this morning that it was like 5.7% volatility.
Well, last night it was 207.5, and the 207.5 puts are 580, and the 207.5 calls are 690. So where are we? It's not even 14; it's like 13.
Right.
I think it's a little light, but
well, we'll see. But yeah, one way or the other, I don't think he's going to disappoint.
Kenny? How much do you? It's kind of a long question, but we've had some people on the show talk about the fact that he or the company is somewhat, lending money to people that are buying into
the circular financing.
Yeah, and I tell you what, I'm not saying anybody should sell anything, but I was involved with Pullman that did that with what the hell's the name of the place that did all the leasing of railroad cars, and I look at the fact that he's like what, four companies or 80 or 70% or 60% of all his sales. That's either like really good for you, or it could be really bad for you. It just makes me nervous. Does it you at all?
Well, it makes me nervous because I think they're all in bed with each other, right? And so that's what makes me nervous, right? If it starts to weaken, then the whole thing is going to weaken. But I have to be honest, they're doing it. Everyone on the street knows it. All these analysts know it. Everybody supports it. So am I missing something, or is everybody just being blinded by the light?
It's hard to say that everybody else is blind but you, or me. But the fact is, it does happen, right?
Yeah, it does. It does happen.
They don't want to see it,
Yeah. So let's see what happens tomorrow when they come out. And then don't forget, Dell is the next week. And Dell's earnings are actually supposed to be very, very good as well. So we'll see. But I don't think the AI trade is dead at all, if that's what we're talking about. Do I think it's stretched? I do. Am I chasing tech names? I'm not. Are there other places to put money in the market? Absolutely. Healthcare, basic materials, industrials are all places. Financials are all places where there are opportunities. So, no. Am I chasing tech up here? No, I'm not. I'm not adding to tech. I'm adding to tech only when there are dislocations in names. But there are no, at the moment, there aren't any that I'm interested in. So, therefore, I'm not chasing it.
What aren't some of these numbers, you know, I mean, last week, you know, Ryan, was it 2 weeks ago where we talked about somebody had crushed the number. It was a Palantir, and how they were up on a huge percentage in terms of revenue, which brought them up to $3.50 a share, which is means they're still, you know, whatever, 30 or 40 some times revenue. Now NVIDIA, in my mind, they have this, you know, they've had this huge accretive move up. They're still up to $10.50. A share in revenue, which is like 21 times revenue. You know, you can't make it to 12 this year and 14 next year or 16 the year after and have this 211 price hold, I don't think. I mean, maybe you can, because they have for a long time. It just seems if they come out with really good news, you know, I don't know. It's whatever you do, you've already celebrated. Remember when you and I were younger, it seemed like some stock would go up before the earnings, and you'd say, wow, the earnings might be good. And all of a sudden, the earnings were like way better than everybody expected, but the market sort of knew it, and all of a sudden, it just stopped there.
You know? Right. It's buy the rumor and sell the news, right? That's what they're doing in NVIDIA, right? That's typically what they do, right? Is they buy the news and sell they buy the rumor and sell the news.
But if the thing, if they come out with, you know, if the revenue goes to $12 a share, which is still pretty darn light, in today's world, sometimes the stock then goes to like 240, and you go, "Wait a minute, shouldn't that already have been in there?" But you know, I don't know. It seems a little different.
Yeah, no, it is different. It's certainly different than when we were kids. But the world has changed, right? The technology's changed. They've become more sophisticated. The strategies become more sophisticated. All the other products out there, right? Whether they're ETFs, levered ETFs, triple levered ETFs. Upwards, downwards, backwards, forwards. I mean, it's nuts what's out there in terms of products in the market that all come at times. They conflict with each other, right?
Well, how much do you think of it is, and this is kind of a long question. We'll talk about it more next week. How much of it is fabric of the market? I mean, we put these earnings out after the close or before. There's not a whole lot of people around. And all of a sudden, if they start to run up, everybody pulls all their offers, which you couldn't do on the New York Stock Exchange back in the day.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you know, the thing is up $40 and you're like, well, how did that happen? I mean, it's hardly not even a trade. It's just...
Yeah, well, it happened because the technology allows it to happen as swiftly as it does, right? And so, you see these massive kind of incredible moves in the market that happen very, very quickly in the post-market, right? And remember, there's also less liquidity. Unless it's a big name, there's typically more liquidity. But in some of these other names in the post-market, there's less liquidity, so those moves are more exaggerated. That won't be the case in NVIDIA because there'll be plenty of people waiting for the NVIDIA number to come out. So there'll be plenty of action, you know, at least in the immediate minutes after in the aftermarket, after the news comes out, because there are just so many interesting parties, right? So there'll be plenty of volume.
Last question, I promise. What do you make of, Carl was talking last week regarding some Chinese outfit, you know, I don't know if I want to go there, but he said they have some chips over there that when they talk about AI, that they're going to be like, I thought he said like 1/10 the cost, and they're going to get you half the way there. And
yeah, the those open weight models, I think you're talking about.
He said for most people, they don't need or want to pay for the real high end stuff. Other stuff is like good enough.
Right. And I think for most people that might be true. Right, for the sophisticated models, no. But for most people that might be true. The only problem that I have with that is, once again, I hate to say it, but it's China, and although I have an Apple phone, so who am I kidding? But it's China, and so I prefer to kind of stay away from it as much as I can. But ultimately, if it's all about cost, it's all about cost.
But we have some attorneys that are in the same kind of same general office area and stuff that use AI, and they have some kind of a subscription. I don't think they even read, even though they're attorneys, that, you know, in a year their stuff is going to go way up. I don't know. I mean, Carl's all over this more than me, but he says that the idea of you're going to have this long-term subscription model where 2 years from now, everyone in the country is going to be paying like $300 a month for AI. He's like, I don't know if that's going to fly. I mean, maybe it will, but it does obviously for some stuff. I mean, it does for Excel and things. But I don't know about that. I mean, these guys are way into this investment, big time.
I mean, so partly they're talking their book too, right? They need it to happen that way.
Oh yeah. So where are you this week? What are you back in New York?
I'm in New York right now. I'm actually going back to Florida this afternoon after I record my Yahoo podcast, and I'm going back to Florida. So
where do you have to go to get on with Maria? She's not on the floor anymore. No,
I was on yesterday on with Maria, right in the studio. She wasn't, and she's on vacation. I was on with Cheryl Pusoni. But I just go to the Fox studio right on 48th Street and 6th Avenue.
Okay, so they're not over in New Jersey like CNBC.
No, like CNBC. No. They're over right up by Radio City.
Okay.
Listen, remember, I'm out for the next 2 weeks because my daughter's getting married, and I'm going to be at her, in Europe at her wedding.
Congratulations on that.
I'll be on with you. I think it's Tuesday the 15th. I think that's the Tuesday.
Yeah. All right, buddy.
That's the next time. All right.
All right. Have a nice time. Tara said congrats.
All right, thanks,
bye-bye. SP Futures up 35, NASDAQ Futures up 27. Do we have Professor Hale?
Hey, what's up? How you guys doing?
Doing all right. We're hanging on. How are you? We're trying to figure out where to... Bessent got $1 trillion to do what he wants with. $1 trillion, sorry.
Well, hey, when you can just auction bonds, I guess you can. I mean, it's a tax on river folks and a subsidy to the investor elite class, so...
Well, if you're an investor elite class, you think that's not a bad idea.
Yeah. Well, I listened to this video on X yesterday about his wife is Ukrainian, and he was saying that the war in Ukraine has been over for a year, and that this war in Ukraine is really about burning the country down to force all the Ukrainians off the land so that these rich, powerful, elite Europeans can move in and gobble up the land. And it made me think of what happened in Maui and L.A. Burn it down, or let it burn down, or burn it down with a war. Move all the common people off the land and then just take it. The alternative is having to pay market prices or above market prices for people who own the land. So I thought that was really interesting.
Well, we've... In our lifetime,
nothing surprises me with these policymakers.
If you want to, you're probably too young. If you want to make yourself sick, and what government?
Oh, this stuff makes me sick. It makes me ill.
Well, I'm just saying, if you really want
it's
to,
it's just theft. The government engages in theft and coercion and force.
Since you always already feel that way, I probably shouldn't even tell you where you should read. Go Google up, or whatever search engine you use, Google up the history of the Resolution Trust in this country.
Yeah.
Have you ever had
I think you mentioned it before.
Yeah, have you ever just grabbed, make sure you got an air sickness bag next to you.
Yeah, it'll make me throw up. And I'm usually not a guy that throws up.
Well, me neither. But that I was who was the guy that was on CNBC that was a poor guy died of a heart attack a long time ago, but he was Bill. Was it Bill Seidman? I think was his name, and he was one of the guys that was managed the Resolution Trust.
Hmm.
And they had, it's sort of the same thing. It's very similar to the
take it over.
Trump's first term, all the soybean farmers up in Minnesota that had trouble because they couldn't get their soybeans to Japan and China. We had had the first thing, and a lot of those guys sold their farms. And I think who the hell was the wasn't Bessent. It was one of the people
very,
in the cabinet.
Very mercantilistic.
The farms came back, but they weren't with the same owners, which is what you're talking about. Well, the Resolution Trust, they took all this stuff that the savings and loans had and basically parceled it out to people. And if they gave you, if you and I ponied up $1 million, we'd probably need some listeners to help us out with that. If we ponied up $1 million, they were going to lend us 80% on that. 90%, but that would be, so they would lend us another 4 to go buy stuff. But if we really got in Dutch with the government, they'd lend us the first $1 million, and then they'd lend us the other 4. How scary is that? And this stuff went for 15, 20, 30 cents on the dollar. And whenever one of my clients at the time, a guy named CW, just use his first name, was a big time not investor, big-time developer in Arizona. He was probably the second biggest guy next to Keating. But he ended up, he was pretty straight. He didn't go to jail like Keating did. And he ended up somewhat okay. I mean, pretty much okay. But he was very involved in all these properties, and they were all being sold off. And they had two or three properties that were, they had some local people paying a certain number for it. And it was, you know, I'm going to say 70 cents on the buck, 65. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like really big. And all of a sudden the thing came from Washington, and a few of the buddies of Bush won. They only wanted to sell stuff to people that could take at least 10 properties.
Yeah.
And these guys could only afford three. So the price that people got for the 10 was appreciably lower than what these guys were willing to pay for those three. So they got the whole 10 at like 40 cents, and I think one of them was the Phoenician. You know, that incredible place that Keating built. Did you ever stay at that place? It's really something. But, I mean, he spent way too much money on the statues and all this stuff. But I tell you what, if you and I could have got it at 30 or 40 cents on the dollar or 25, even you and I can make money with a place at that price. So, I mean,
well, it's kind of like the banking. Yeah. It's kind of like what happened during the Great Depression with checking accounts and savings accounts.
Yeah, well,
If the bank had a run and you lost your savings, you still had to pay the mortgage. You didn't lose the mortgage, you lost your savings, right?
Did they have, my grandfather bought their house, it was like 2 weeks before the, did they have mortgages in, they had mortgages for farms, but did they have mortgages for regular houses in 29 or 28?
Yeah, you know what, I think a lot of people, most people probably, well, they had mortgages for slaves in the South.
Well, I know people.
Sure, they probably had, there were probably some mortgages for homes.
But I know people, when they say they used to mortgage the farm, did they do that for the money for the seeds for planting and fertilizer, or did you just go buy a farm and have a mortgage on that? I mean, I don't think it was 30 years, was it?
In the Netflix series, I don't remember it being in the book, but because I was too young when I read the book, but in the Netflix series, Little House on the Prairie, the new one, the Ingalls have mortgaged their farm in Wisconsin to a friend, and then the friend has a stroke, and the friend is no longer to make that mortgage payment. So they have to consider whether they should go back to Minnesota to foreclose on their friend who agreed to buy their farm. So, you know, I don't remember that being in the book, because when you're, you know, in sixth grade reading Little House on the Prairie, words like mortgage don't really mean anything to you, right?
Yeah.
But I just thought that was rather interesting. I think there were mortgages, but culturally, Americans were anti-debt. There were debtor prisons in the United States. And until the central bank was formed, most people stored their money probably in a coffee jar, a coffee can in their home or under their mattresses, until the Federal Reserve came around and started inflating the currency. And that made saving in your in mattress or saving in your coffee can impossible, because your money lost value. Before the Federal Reserve, your money didn't lose value, it actually appreciated.
Just according to your friends at AI, no, traditional long-term fixed-rate fully amortizing mortgages did not exist in 1928.
Mm-hmm. But you still had to pay the loans, though.
Right? Instead of the modern 30-year home loan, home financing in the late 20s relied on short-term high-risk structures.
Mm-hmm.
Most loans.
If you had a loan, you didn't get out of the loan. You lost your savings in your checking account, but you lost your loan. You kept your loan. Your loans were sold to whoever purchased the borrowers
typically had to put down 40 to 6% in cash, and the most loans were 3 to 5 years with the entire remaining balance came due. So they were essentially short term with balloons.
Yeah. My point is, you didn't get out of the loan. The loan didn't disappear, but your deposit disappeared.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. I actually thought that what happened in 2007-08, you know, who cares what I think, but
that's another example of what we're talking about.
Well, and I think the difference is
the money that Bush and Obama spent on TARP went to banks getting even bigger, because they're purchasing the smaller banks.
Well, that's right. And by the way, did you see the CNBC article yesterday? Was it Wells Fargo and Citigroup are looking to buy a bank because they're under the 10% maximum, where the other two are above, and nothing happens to them. So they think they got room to buy another bank. Do we really think those guys to buy another bank? I think no. But
The cartel just gets more and more concentrated.
But anyway, my my question to you is, and, since you are the professor, the 29 thing I think had a lot of similarities with the 2007 thing, and you know, everybody talks about the 2007-2008 where people got way out on their skis and blah blah blah, and which is, you know, it's not like that's not true.
That happens when the central bank is
right, but I'm saying but everybody forgets, I think, that most of the people that lost money were regular people. The price of a house, the median price of a house was around $235,000 in 2007, which means that if your parents gave you your inheritance early, if you saved up the money, whatever you did, you put down, say, $45,000. I'll make it easy. And all of a sudden, the house was worth $175,000, and you had to move. So it wasn't you know, you and I.
Well, and a lot of those people were convinced by the media and the government to.
Well, whatever happened, the fact is, it was their equity. Now, the same thing in 1920.
They tap their equity, they go on vacation to Jamaica.
Right, I'm trying to get to my question here. Is it same thing in 1929? Hal's great grandmother went down to the bank, and all her savings are in the bank. Say it's $900. All of a sudden, the door hits her in the nose, and she doesn't have the $900. It's one thing to be laid off for a month, maybe go do a couple odd jobs and come back, get your job back. That's a business cycle recession. I thought that 2007 was like 29 in a sense. It was a balance sheet recession. It just yanked your wealth out from under you and was never coming back.
Yeah.
And the housing price came back, but you weren't in it anymore. And if you got transferred, you basically ate the $45,000 that you put down. And if you went somewhere,
yeah, I had friends and family members who were upside down in their mortgages, and they lost their job and they just walked away from it.
Well, even if they
left the keys in their car too.
But most people put down 20% at the time, even though they claim everybody else, you know, everybody got in for 1%. Regular people didn't. They put down 10 or 20%.
Well, right? They might have put down 10 or 20%, but when the Federal Reserve prints a bunch of money and has interest rates artificially low, you know, you tap that home equity, you go out on vacation.
Okay, now I'm talking about
you don't have the 20% equity.
I'm talking about the people who paid $235,000 and 2 years later. Yeah. Had a walk, and the bank got most of theirs back, and those people didn't.
Well, I had a friend or family member who bought a house for $150,000 in about 2005, and then the home value went up to $250,000. They put a lot of, the person bought an RV and went into debt, paid off some past debts with equity, and all of a sudden 2008 comes and their house is back to $150,000. And they end up walking away because they owe $250,000.
Wait, he didn't walk away. He drove away in the RV. RV to live in.
Well, I think the RV was left behind too.
I'm saying, if he had a big RV, what's the difference? He just took off.
Left the keys in the house.
Left the keys
in Florida. In Florida, I don't know if you know this, but Vanilla Ice, the guy, you know, known as Vanilla Ice, he was rehabbing those mansions in Florida, and he had a show, and he'd walk into a mansion that he had purchased at bargain-based prices. And all the copper was removed. They took all the copper out. Oh, yeah. The wire.
Well, they always used to do that. Piping. Yeah, they took all your washing machines for scrap value.
And he used to take the copper. In The Godfather, leave the gun, take the cannoli.
Yeah. Well, remember with
leave the keys and take the copper.
I don't know if you ever watched Blue Bloods, but Tom Selleck takes the grandkid out for dinner, and he goes, now here's one tip. If you can't afford the car and the apartment, keep the car. You can sleep in the car. You can't drive the apartment. Of course, in New York, you wouldn't do that because you don't need to drive anywhere anyway. But
yeah, you got a subway, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you heard Dr. Johnson on a couple of weeks ago, and he's doing a lot of psychological work. And he's retired, but he's doing, you know, helping people out in New York. All the people in New York that are losing their IT jobs.
Yeah.
And he said these guys are in their 30s and 40s, but he said that the stress when your rent is like $10,000 a month, you don't. Yeah. Nobody has more than 2 or 3 months to find a job before you're just out.
Yeah,
it's not like you're paying $1,200 a month like people used to. And because you've got nobody's got a $100,000 kitty to look for a job for 10 months in New York.
Yeah. I read an article about solopreneurship. Solopreneurship is where a person opens up a business and they have no employees. And apparently there's like 29 million Americans who are solo entrepreneurs. And that's what I was predicting when I was teaching an entrepreneur class at Westminster University in Utah. It was a graduate level course. I was predicting that in the future, we're either going to be a macro entrepreneur where we use robots and AI, or we're all going to be micro entrepreneurs. I call it micro entrepreneurs, but they call it.
So is that what a dog, is that what a dog walker is?
Well, that's what the car parker was in that Seinfeld episode that George screwed up.
Well, I mean,
this guy was parking cars. He's making bank just parking people's cars, $50 a month to park like 30 cars or something, man. It was crazy.
Well, I know guys that used to do that when Northwestern had a football game. They would, you know, really park on everybody's lawn.
Yeah.
Why not?
Well, when you went to football games, when you go to football games at the Rose Bowl, at least this was the case when I went to the Oklahoma Washington State University Rose Bowl in 2004, there was no parking at all. There was no public transportation. I don't know how, that's one reason why that stadium was never full, because they built that stadium probably in what was a farm community and then houses and a golf course surrounded now. And so there's no freaking parking. And me and my Washington State University fellow students, I was a graduate student there, all undergrads, we rode in somebody's back of their truck to get to the game. But we didn't think about how we're going to get back to our hotel after the game was over. We were stuck at the Rose Bowl. I don't even remember how we got home. I think we made it was crazy.
I've never been there, but it strikes me.
It's a golf course.
It's out in the middle of nowhere. What is out there?
It's houses and a golf course and a 100,000-seat stadium. It's
but
crazy.
The thing was built. The Irish played there. They didn't play. Yeah. They didn't play a bowl game from somewhere in the '20s to 1973. And the one in the '20s, I think, was at Army.
I think it was farming ground when they.
But it was in the Rose Bowl. What could possibly have been out there in 1920?
I think it was farm ground. Seriously, it was like Long Island during.
But why would somebody? Where'd they get the money to build it? Why there?
Well, they did. It was originally dug into the dirt, and then they eventually did like what Michigan did. They started building it above ground. So it was really a bowl. A stadium bowl is one that's dug into the dirt, and then when the game gets popular enough, now they got to build above the ground.
But, I mean, there's no transportation out there other than driving, right?
Yeah, well, back then you would just park your tractor, your Ford or your DeSoto, right, on farm ground probably. But it was, I think it was probably farm ground when they first built it.
Well, now UCLA plays. How far is it from UCLA?
Oh, yeah. You know, the funny thing about that is the NCAA did not like Idaho playing in their home games, and they're trying to make Division I transfer. They didn't like Idaho playing 7 miles away at Washington State University's Martin Stadium. But they're okay with UCLA having to go. It's a longer drive from UCLA downtown. UCLA's campus is down by Rodeo Drive, and the Rose Bowl is way out there in Pasadena. The drive from UCLA to Pasadena is much farther, probably five times longer than it is for Idaho to drive 7 miles to Pullman.
Groundbreaking was 1922.
Yeah, and I'm sure it was probably farm ground.
And we get a little of this. It began in 22. It was finished in October of 22. And they had a game. It must have been, it must not have been as big as it is now.
Well, the Empire State Building was built in a year, I think. Within a year.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's just, you wonder why out there, and it continues to catch fire, but it's not like they ever built a train line or anything out there, did they?
No, I think what people did, California is a driving culture. I think what people did is they just parked on people's farm ground.
How many people had cars in 1922?
Yeah. Well, back in 1922, it was probably only 25,000 to 30,000 people.
They didn't even have Model A's yet. It was Model T's, right?
Yeah, yeah. The kind of car that you had to drive backwards up Malad Pass. That's what my grandpa used to tell me.
Well, reverse was the lowest gear, right?
Yeah, you'd go backwards up Malad Pass on the old highway in Utah.
Well, I think reverse was lower than first gear.
It was, yeah, definitely, yeah.
Oh, God. So what?
Well, I had a 68 Ford where first was, like, so low a gear that I could literally pull a tree out of the ground with that truck. It was so low geared.
Oh yeah, they had the granny gear, they call them. You never use it to start out. Yeah. You never use it to start out in.
Yeah. Oh yeah, my cousin Adam, he wanted to borrow my truck one day, and he started it. He couldn't get it out of first, but he had it in granny gear. And I go, dude, you can't start in first. You got to start in second.
Plus, the first wasn't even synchronized.
Yeah, it was crazy, man.
Yeah,
yeah. That truck was awesome because, you know, when you had to shift the gear, it didn't have any power assist on the brakes and the steering, and your knee literally came up to your chest when you pushed the clutch. And yeah. So I got really good at.
Well, it depends on the car. I mean, the Jeeps, the Wranglers. If I would have owned one of those things, if I had a stick shift, I couldn't have driven it because I could only. In order for me to clutch, my knee had to go outside the door.
Yeah,
because there was no leg room.
You get really good at shifting without the clutch. You find the mesh point, and it just slides right in. You can go from second to third without the clutch.
Well, but you can't downshift like that.
Yeah, you can shift. It's very subtle too. You put a little pressure on it, and it slips out of second into third without the clutch.
I think a lot of the over road drivers know how to do that too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the old 18-wheelers.
Yeah. Well, hey, what is in terms of me? You know, it's what I do for a living is invest for people, and it seems like all I'm doing is. Getting pissed off at the politics because it's maneuvering the market around. It seems like whatever happens, those guys end up making money. You know, it's kind of.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I'm reading this morning how much Trump's up on his oil stocks.
My wife and I are trying to hang on to our real estate. That's what we're trying to do because they're going to create inflation and real estate's going to go up in value.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the question I was asking, you know, Kenny, I think that even you know they're not my favorite people in the administration. I think that they're. I'm hoping. There's somebody. How far are they going to push this? I mean, we've several administrations have done it. It's not just them, you know, pushing money supply, pushing the value of stuff up, having inflation a problem for just about everybody, lying about it, saying it's not as big of a problem. Everybody knows it is. But this has been a 20-some year game, and now we're accelerating it.
It's actually been since the Fed was organized game.
Yeah, no, it wasn't.
It got out of control over the last 20 years.
It.
But the Fed has turned the dollar into a penny over its history.
The Fed actually was fined during World War II. They were fined during the 50s.
Tom, I got to disagree with that because when the Fed first started, it stated the goal was to be the lender of last resort, but bank failures actually were much, much higher during the first 10 years of the Fed.
Well, that's because they turned out to not be the lender of last resort. That's the problem.
Yeah, because they wanted the big banks to get even bigger, so they had they basically encouraged bank failure of the small banks, so that the big banks could get bigger.
The standard fare of the monetarists, and by the way, I don't agree with this. I mean, there's times that I disagree with my leader Milton Friedman.
I've been watching a lot of Milton Friedman videos. He's really good in interviews.
Oh God, yeah. He's a brilliant man.
The Phil Donahue.
The only problem is if you asked him a question, the answer was more complicated than the one you didn't understand in the first place.
Actually, he's really good on Phil Donahue. Rewatch the tape on Phil Donahue.
So well,
okay, Walter, but, I saw Walter Williams on, I think, Phil Donahue.
But sometimes when people
he was so good too.
Look at the macro, they forget the micro. And I think, yeah. By the way, speaking of which, we got to go to break. I'll say this.
Well, my macro course is founded on micro principles. When I'm talking recessionary gaps and expansionary gaps, it's founded on those micro principles. So I try to overcome the macro.
Right. What I'm saying is, if you listen to those guys, which I did, yeah. They would say that the cause of the Great Depression was not the crash. It wasn't, you know, the fact that
the crash was a result of a monetary expansion.
Whatever. What I'm saying is they claim the depression was because the Federal Reserve allowed the money supply to decrease by 25 or 35% in like a 6-month period after the crash.
Well, but the Fed also did something.
I understand, but
they started raising the reserve requirement on these banks.
They did a lot of crummy stuff. But yeah. What I'm saying is I don't think that the answer always was from Friedman and his people was, if the Fed would have somehow poured money into the system, that wouldn't have happened. And
yeah, I don't regret that. I don't think that.
Well, I think. Well, here's where I'm asking you to grade this paper. I think if Hal's grandmother went into the bank and all of a sudden her $4,000 wasn't there, I agree with the part that you need to put money back in the system. But if you didn't have a mechanism, almost like a FDIC in reverse, if you didn't find the people like your grandmother and say, we're putting $2,000 back in to her account, I don't know if you could do the whole four, but if you don't get it back to the people who lost it and just dumped it to the people who didn't lose it, I think then you create inflation and you really screw your grandmother more than she was screwed anyway. I mean,
because she's got now deal with the
prices. I mean, if you don't, it's sort of like the mortgage, the alleged help they gave everybody in 2008. If they didn't get it to the person who lost the $45,000 on the house and is now living somewhere else in an apartment with another job, if you don't get it back to him, you help somebody, but you don't help the right people.
Let's
put it this way. You help the right people. You help your friends. I guess they are the right people.
The help that they offered with artificially lowering the interest rate and to lower the payment, I didn't get that as a responsible home buyer in 2004. I bought a house well within my means at a low interest rate. I didn't get any
help. But that didn't go to the buyer who was screwed. It goes to the next guy.
Well, what happened is when you offset principal and lower the interest rate artificially through government action,
I agree.
It actually creates a moral hazard, and the people who got that benefit, they don't change their behavior.
They're also not the people that lost it. We got to go to break. They're not the people who lost the dough. Is my point. Yeah. You're giving the discount to the next guy. That's why it's always good to be the next guy, not the first guy. Yeah. Right? SP Futures up 20.
Anytime the government subsidizes something, it creates a moral hazard.
Without a doubt. SP Futures up 27, NASDAQ Futures up 220. We'll be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now.
Hello, everybody. Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 27. NASDAQ Futures up 220. We have Caterpillar up another $19. Caterpillar is flying back and forth, and maybe Kevin will give us a story tomorrow. But somehow or another, they bought some place that kind of puts them in the AI world. I mean, you would never expect just a big bulldozer company to be doing this kind of movement. But they're 2-4%, you know, several times a week, which never used to happen, but it is now. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei up 328.5%. Hang Seng down 6. Call that flat. Nothing going on there. Shanghai up 7, call that flat. Just a way of review yesterday as we're bouncing back today, S&P was down 21, NASDAQ was down 200, so we're almost exactly up a hair more than we were down yesterday. So what that tells you, I don't know exactly. DAX up 192.7%, FTSE up 10, call that flat. FTSE has not been going the same as the DAX in any kind of degree for a while now. Kakaran up 26.3%, so I'm going to say bullish over there. Stock futures rise as Treasury yields decline. Chipmakers gain ahead of NVIDIA earnings. And we've had 2-3 days now of long-term rates down because, I mean, Bessent continues to threaten to buy more of these bonds, so you really don't want to be a seller if he's going to run $1 trillion at you unless you've got $1 trillion to fight him. I don't know about that. Bonds, like I said, down 4 basis points, 4.67 on the 10-year. Still over the 4.5 panic number, but now evidently a new number is 4.75, so it's not there. We have oil down 267, so that's good news, 82.34. RBOB 324, so you're paying over 4, I know I did, in Illinois, because we've got the 90-some cents taxes here. Unless you got to give a little something guy to the station attendant, at least a little something. Gold down 680, 46.91. Gold and Bitcoin have been a huge benefactor of this pouring money into the system. Crypto up 25 hours. Matter of fact, Wall Street Journal had an article yesterday talking about how somewhere they got a quote from Bessent saying that he is trying to shove Bitcoin up. Now, of course, everybody in the administration seems to own Bitcoin. I can't believe that's an arm's length sort of deal, but, and I didn't, you know, I read bits and pieces of the article, but foreign exchange, we've got the British pound unchanged at 116.7. I mean, British pound unchanged at 136. Euro down unchanged 116.7. And we've got the yen creeping closer to this 160 number, 159.28. So maybe Bessent might have to be going to use, hopefully not, more of that money to buy more yen like he did a few weeks ago. A lot of stuff, Ricky. What do you got for us, traffic, weather, sports?
Hey, good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:41 a.m. here in Chicago. We're looking at 64 degrees right now with a high of 78. Partly sunny and very nice weather today. Tonight will be partly cloudy with a low of 67 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 88 degrees right now with 116 a high. Mostly sunny with record-breaking temperatures today. Tonight, mainly clear and very warm with a low of 89 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Emma Kennedy from Monroe's is 29 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 49 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf is 53 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th, we got 32 minutes. And lastly, Stevenson from 294 is 39 minutes. For the MLB, yesterday, the White Sox lost to Rangers 11-2, but still maintained the lead in their division at 68-63. Cubs hammered Diamondbacks 7-0. Currently sitting in second place of NL Central at 76-56, and Diamondbacks are third in their division at 69-63. Today we got Rangers at White Sox 6:40 p.m. and Cubs at Diamondbacks 8:40 p.m. Lastly, NFL preseason week 3 starts this Thursday, August 27, but Bears don't play Titans until Sunday at 5 p.m. That's all I got for you, Chief. Back to you.
Hell, you got your fan duel or whatever you got for me betting on all these games all year, betting on every kick and everything.
I don't bet on sports. And the last person I want to listen to are the experts in sports, because the experts are expert at being wrong.
Oh, yeah. It's
watch the predictions before in the pregame shows. These guys have PhDs, essentially, in whatever sport they play, and yet they have a kind of a 50-50 record. And it got so bad, I think. Now they will look at games, in my opinion, that they're all making predictions on games where it's almost a sure thing. They won't make predictions on all games during the day. So I don't bet. I think it's all flip of the coin. And the only thing that I will bet on, because I like doing it, is blackjack, and that's it. That's the only thing I'll bet on, because you can win at blackjack if you have a little skill. If you have a little knowledge and you have a feel for the cards, you can win at blackjack.
Are you a card counter?
I'm not a card counter because I don't do it enough. I think if I did it every day, and if I played blackjack every day, I'd be a really good card counter. But I just don't do it enough. I play blackjack once every 10 years.
Do you know the basic strategies?
I have a basic strategy. I have a feel for it. I understand probability theory. I know how many kings and aces and nines are in the deck, so I have a pretty good idea. I have a subjective feel about it, but if I did it every day and I chose that as my occupation, I think I'd be really good at blackjack.
But you never read Beat the Dealer?
I never read it, no. I haven't even watched the movies, but, you know, when I was a kid, my brothers and I, we didn't have a lot of toys. You know, there was 2 months where we didn't even have electricity because my mom couldn't pay the electricity bill. So we played a lot of board games, and we played a lot of card games, and we got really good.
Do you hit a 4, 5, or 6 against a 10?
Yeah. Well, you know, honestly, I don't know any of the lingo at all. I don't know what double down means. I have none of that. No idea.
Wait a minute. How can you play without knowing what a double down means?
It's because I just have. It's like when I was in the Navy. When I was in the Navy for 6 years, because I was only on the ship for about a year and a half, I was either out partying if it was my day off, or as in the engine room for 20 hours a day.
All right, for those that don't know, double down, if you get your first two cards and you bet 10 bucks, I don't know if you can bet 10 bucks anymore, you get to throw the two cards up, take only one card, and double your bet.
Yeah.
All right,
like me being in the Navy. In the Navy, I didn't even know what the bow or the stern is. To this day, I don't know what the bow or stern is. Well, I just didn't it didn't affect my job, so I could care less about what the bow and the stern was. My job was in the engine room, right?
Well, if the guy says I'll meet you on the bow, we'll go drinking, and you went to the stern, you weren't going to meet the dude.
I would have been in the wrong.
You'd been the wrong end of the boat.
It would have been a 50-50 coin flip. I would have thought, all right, I'm going to flip a coin. Heads, I'll go to the pointy part. Tails, I'll go to the flat part.
Hey, speaking of which, So anyway, real quick on my double down story. So if you get, if your cards are a six and a five, and the dealer's got like a six up, which means he's a has a 45% chance of busting, you throw up the six and the five, that's an 11. And you double down, you only get one card. So the idea, if you get a 10, you got 21, but you can't get an 11, you can't bust. So so even if you get a 10, you figure you got a winner. You don't always have, but or a 10 or a 9 or an 8, you got a really good hand.
Or two fives or a 6 and a 5.
Well, no, you get, yeah, you only get one, you know, one card. Yeah.
Oh, you only get one, okay.
But and
so, no, but every time I played blackjack, I walked away with more money than I started with.
You have a really good, you know.
I've only played blackjack at casinos twice in my life, and both times I walked away with
good
next
for you.
$200.
Good for you. Hey, I saw.
And it's just a feel for it. It's just a feel for it and understand the probabilities. And I have no, I don't know the language at all, but you know, I do know how many of different each suit is in there. You know, I know that, right? So you can come up with these probabilities in your head.
Well, so you're not my Navy guy.
If I play every day and I read the books, I can be a good card counter.
I think so, too. Hey, I got a question for you. More than a question. Hey, since I knew you were coming on today, and we've got these issues with the Navy, and I read...
Yeah, that shit that's coming out of the Persian Gulf, they hadn't had a port call.
200 days.
I thought maybe they had port calls, but they've been away from their home.
I told you that 2 weeks ago, and as usual, you don't believe me.
Well,
they were gone.
I just read that because they're port call.
They were out. I said they were out for 270 days total, but hadn't had a port call in 200. I told you that 2 weeks ago.
Well, what I thought you meant is they've been away from their home port.
No, that was the 270, but they hadn't had a port. So, but yesterday, here's what I...
Well, you know, the Navy experience is different than when I was in the Navy, because in the Navy, if you wanted to listen to music, you had to have CDs, and that took up room in your locker, right? My locker was half CDs. Today, everything's on your phone. I think they have Wi-Fi on these ships. You can have DVDs, or you can have movies downloaded on your laptop and your phone, so it's much less of a problem than what it would have been back then. Back then, if you got a message from your mom, it was not email; it was like a teletype kind of thing. So the experience today is much different than, and my day was much better than it was during World War II. In World War II, my stepfather was sleeping in a freaking hammock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, here's what my question.
I think it's more tolerable today.
Well,
if we didn't have a port call for 6 months on the Truxton, people would have been jumping over the ship and swimming home.
Well, they said one guy tried it on this thing. But here's my question for you. They were talking about, and we had this long conversation with whatever the hell was that yesterday about wasn't Carl? It was it must have been Jan Flanagan about the, or maybe it was Kevin, about the. Some of the skills we've lost. And by the way, they're right about that. When other people are making stuff, that's where you make a lot of your advancements on the factory floor, right? So if you're on the factory floor, you're not going to be doing that. But they're talking about the Navy and these nuclear-powered aircraft carriers and the Nimitz. And I didn't realize, I mean, until you actually listen to the detail, you think you know something, but you sort of don't. They're talking about how all the aircraft carriers, all the nuclear aircraft carriers are made in Newport News, Virginia.
Yeah,
and there's a company. I forget the name of it, but they got this massive dry dock. They got all this stuff. They put all this stuff together, and how the lead time. These are hell questions. The lead time for the, you know, for the, you know, drive shafts and for the nuclear components could be years, right? I mean, I'm sure you.
Oh yeah.
And so they're saying that when these things are designed to last for 50 years, okay, but the Nimitz class, which is the ones that are trying to retire but can't yet. At the end of 25 years, you got to totally refuel, basically tear the whole thing apart, and almost rebuild it. I mean, you're not rebuilding, you know, the bottom of it, but it's a 3-year project, and it's only done at this one place, same place where they're built. Now, allegedly, the new ones, the Ford class, the reactor is supposed to last the whole 50 years without having to do that to it. Now, of course,
wow, that's pretty impressive.
Well, but the jury's out on that, right? So,
yeah.
But I mean, it's all planned for this maintenance. So they started talking about it. Was it the Stennis? Is one of the ones in there? The giant Stennis was in the came in late into the redo pit. Now the redo pit is like the same, it's either the same one or it's very right next to the one for the new construction. So the people, it takes like 2 or 3 years to have a nuclear welder to be certified in that. You probably know about that. And you know, it's a whole different class of people. There's not that many people. So it's not like we can build 2 aircraft carriers at the same time as we can one, because the same people are doing it. Well, it's evidently the same people are doing the midlife redo as they're building the new ones. So they're saying when the Stennis or whatever the first one in was 6 months to a year late getting out, that meant the next one coming in was 6 months to a year getting back in. And the fact that the Ford was over, took longer than they thought, and now the Kennedy's taking longer than they thought, it's affecting the rehabs. So the limits is supposed to be being retired. They can't even retire it because the law says you got to have 11 aircraft carriers out there. Well, it's out there, but I don't know if it can go like to the Mediterranean or someplace. So, but the whole thing became very interesting in how it's amazingly piggy move up, where if you lose 3 or 4 weeks on one, and they said all this stuff, and I remember this, Hal, when I was very young and doing, you know, they said, well, what if we build a new plant? What if we did this? I did some of this for the SIBO when we were going to buy the Pecost. When you do, they call it sensitivity analysis, when you do this kind of finance work, you know what I'm talking about. But generally, if you put a project down and you say, okay, I'll make it simple, we're going to build a building. And now, okay, you've got interest rates, you've got this, you've got construction time, you got lead time for the air conditioners, you got the, there's probably 30 variables there. It gets to the point where you can really get screwed by one of the variables or two, and it really doesn't affect you all that much if you build a little cushion in there. But if you get slightly screwed by like 8 of the variables, like it's going to run 2 months over, oh, by the way, your interest costs are going to go up a little bit here, and oh, by the way, it's going to take you a while to get your permits, and oh, by the way, this particular the elevator doors are going to be late. If you put a 10% screwage on like 5 variables, it's way worse than like an 80% screwage on 2 variables, which unless you actually work through it, it's kind of counterintuitive. But what this guy's summation was, when you take the Lincoln being out there that long, it maybe has to get in for redo sooner. But by the way, it's backed up because 2 guys are a little late. When you start, all these things start happening at once, it really creates a mess, more than you would ever guess, because the Navy is okay with 1 or 2 going over, or this. If 1 or 2 things happen, they can deal with it. If 4 or 5 happen, they can't, because there's only one spot. And it's a long, long way to ask a question, but do you understand what these guys are talking about? I bet you do.
Yeah, I mean, when you're out that long, you'd be amazed about how salty seawater erodes the hull of a ship too. You have to factor that in too. I mean, you got salt water that is constantly corroding metal. All you have to do is know, buy a property on the beach in Florida and come back a year later, everything is rusted out. So the air is salty. And if the air is salty, guess what? Everything on that ship that's made of steel is going to, or metal, is going to be rusting, right? So when you're out that long, there's no way that crew can keep up with all that. There's just no way. I don't think they can. So it's just, it's going to be probably in dry dock for a long time.
Well, the ship you were on, the Truxton, and I read up on it because obviously, since you were on it, and you're one of my favorite people, I was going to read up all about it. I got to the question. What is the
reason? You probably know more about it than I do.
Well, but it was designed for 31 knots. It had all this stuff going on the thing. And you were saying the last gasp, the thing's going like 10 or 12. I guess my question.
We hadn't refueled. I think we were getting ready for decommissioning, so they were going to refuel it. And when you get to that stage of a nuclear power plant, with a nuclear power plant back then, and it needs a refueling, you have to be very careful when you open and close the valves. There's like a xenon buildup if you open up too much, and if you open the valves too much, you could have a xenon shutdown. A xenon is a nuclear isotope of uranium-235, and you could have too much of it in the core, and then you won't build a steam. So we had to go constant speed of like probably 15 knots, I think.
Well, the question has to come up. What good were you to anybody out there? What could you have done?
Yeah. Yeah. We joked that we were the target. We were a target. So we were the in the nuclear Navy or in the machinist mate field, there are things called sacrificial anodes, like zinc tablets inside of a condenser on the seawater side. It corrodes before the metal corrodes, right? You want something to corrode. It's like in a water heater. You have these zinc pellets that are screwed in or bolted into inside the water heater. And you want that to corrode before the other components corrode. So we always joke that we were a sacrificial anode. So if the carrier group got under attack, they would put the Truxton out in front so we had to absorb all the missiles.
You guys were the target. But I mean, who could?
That's what we joked about.
But I mean, the aircraft carrier's going 28 knots. Well, you guys couldn't even keep up.
Yeah, I don't think the only ship I ever saw was the supply vessel, the resupply vessel that we'd get every month. That's the only vessel I saw out there. Of course, I was always in the engine room, and rarely did I come up topside and go outside and look around. Most of the time I was in the plane, you know, 20 hours a day. But the only ships I saw, and we were in a carrier group, the only ships I saw were the resupply ships. The Cape Cod. I think it was the Cape Cod back then.
Well, all right, I'm going to switch pages on you one more time. We only have a few minutes. Where is the... If nobody, and again, I'm not just blaming these guys, if nobody decides they're going to... Well, I don't know if you heard the... I listened to this thing last week on YouTube, and this guy was making the case that... And he's drawn parallels between the 1929 situation and today, which money flowing in basically was all speculation. The money blew in because of speculation in the stock market, because you create money by doing that because of all the borrowing, right? And which is kind of what we're doing now, even though last month, actually, the margin loans went down. So there's some hope there, I guess. But
yeah, but the trend over the long run is up. So.
Right. But I guess my point is the guy made a statement that I never thought of, and I try and think, you know, with all you guys on the show, I think of a lot of stuff, but he said, you know, you can't cross the line. And then he goes, you know, okay, what's the line? He goes, the line is when you're so far basically over where you ought to be that even an intelligent adjustment to try and fix it is enough to cause a problem.
Yeah.
And I never thought of that. And he said, the Fed basically sat on their ass in 1929 and just watched it. He said, and then
honestly, I don't believe that they were doing that. I think. Honestly, what my opinion is on.
Okay, but let's listen to the guy's point.
They wanted bank failure so they could get these
whatever.
Bigger
banks. But the point is, it got to the point where there was so much speculation. The prices were so high, but then it's not like now. The speculation was. With 10 cents, you could borrow 90 cents for stock. So it was way worse than now. But he said, once it gets to a point, if you were to say, okay, tomorrow this 90% isn't going to fly, we're going to say that you need 15 cents down on the dollar. He goes, even that small amount of sensible move, because you're so far out there, that causes the crash. And he goes, you can never let it get that way again. And like right now, if you were to say, we're gonna cut money supply growth down to nothing for the next 2 years to try and catch up with this inflation. You know, we're gonna put a 10% bank reserve requirement in, and oh, by the way, we're gonna make, you know, your stock initial margin instead of 50, which is still pretty high. If you're gonna go to 55, he says, if we go much further, even if you did that, you will cause the crash, even by being intelligent and trying and being sensible. What do you think of that? What do you think of that? I never thought of it that way, so I don't know.
All crashes are preceded by an inflation caused by the central bank printing money and keeping interest rates low and creating all kinds of moral hazards. That's where all crashes come from.
All right, you and I agree on that, but he's saying the actual day, if you get too far out there, even any attempt at fix it, that's the day it crashes, because there's no way to fix it.
Well, Hayek said anytime government intervenes, it creates unintended consequences. I like to think that they're intended. let's just go with unintended consequences. So now,
by the way, I'm with you on that. You got a co-conspirator there, you know that.
Yeah. So let's just call it unintended consequences. When you intervene in the marketplace, now you created two consequences. Now you need policy to fix each of those consequences. And so if each intervention has two consequences, all of a sudden, what you're using to fix, all those fixes, create an overbearing regulatory state. And so when people talk about deregulating, they're not talking about going from all the regulation that we have to zero regulation. They're talking about deregulating, backing up one step.
Yeah.
After 150 steps of all these interventions. When they talk about deregulating, they're not talking about going to purely free market,
last question. What if Warsh comes out tomorrow and said, money supply growth is going to 1%. We're not going to buy stuff on the balance sheet. And by the way, Congress, if you're going to spend more next year than you're taking in, you better find a way to tax it or borrow it, because I'm not helping you. What do you think happens in the market?
Well, I think you would cause a panic and you'd cause collapse. But over the long run, you'd be in a much better and more healthy place.
But do you think the people who
stock... And nobody wants to take that short.
Nobody wants to take that hit, especially when those are the people that are in charge.
Especially those people running for re-election this year.
Yeah, well, I get it.
Or a president who might be impeached.
S&P futures up 27, Nasdaq futures up 217. Might need you to pile in tomorrow a little bit. We've got Eric.
You want me to pile in tomorrow?
I'll let you know, because I think Eric is going to join us every other week on Wednesday, which will be great. So we have a Wednesday to fill every other week. So I'll let you know. You were
all right, cool.
I could put you and Carl on and just go sit back and relax. Nice job, Ricky. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.